Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing one of our leading historians, Lady Antonia Fraser, who last week in a rare double turned 93 and published her latest book, The House That Spoke, The History of a Home. And I think, Antonia, it's your 40th book, am I right?
I make it 40.
Yes, well, that's pretty good.
And not bad.
I think it's some kind of record. And your first book, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, came out in 1954. So 71 years between the first and the latest is, again, that must be some kind of record.
I wouldn't dare claim that, because there's always someone who's done something much more amazing.
When they were a baby, possibly wrote their first book. And Tony, tell me about the genesis of this latest book, about the house we're sitting in, fantastic house in West London.
Well, when Hugh, my first husband, Hugh Fraser, and I first married, we had very, very little money, but we did need a house, particularly as we had our first two children very quickly. And one day, Willa Harrod, the widow of Roy Harrod, the great economist, rang up and said, "I hear you're looking for a house." And I said, "We're actually looking for a home," in a rather frosty voice. And she said, "We'll come round." And I then said to Hugh, "Can we afford a house?" He said, "No, but go on." So I went and I was taken in next door. I was taken in next door to them, and everything was dark and brown. There were no windows, sort of garden with no way of getting in. Extraordinarily unkempt. It had been lived in by the last person for 40, if not 50 years. And nothing apparently had been done. And I was just thinking, this is not quite what I had in mind, when I heard a voice, very clear, nice voice, saying, "Don't go." And it was the house that spoke.
And that's the principle that runs all the way through the book, this terrific house speaking to you.
Well, in a way, it's really a book about home. It's, I mean, in a way, likely, it's the theme, wouldn't you say? The theme is home.
Yes, yes, because it's about your previous homes, because I think you've lived here for 66 years, which is a pretty good
66
record.
Years. Cheers.
That's a pretty good record. But as a child, you'd lived in Oxford with your father, the Oxford Don, Lord Longford, and your mother, the biographer Lady Longford. You stayed in the same house pretty much the same time, and then you went to lodge with Anthony Pole. I must say, I'm a cousin of Antonia, so my great-uncle, your uncle, in Regent's Park.
Yes, because my parents went to live in Hampstead Garden suburb and beyond, and I was a wallflower party because no one could afford to take me home in a taxi. And I put my lack of social success entirely down to this. no other cause possible. And my aunt Violet, as she was, Violet Pole, angelically said, "Well, Antonia, come and lodge with us." And she named a tiny sum, which even I could afford, which, incidentally, I don't think she ever took.
Oh, how decent she was.
She's very
wonderfully
generous.
Kind, yes.
But she said, "You can come and lodge here." And so, little did I know it, when I got up from breakfast and Violet said, "Time to get up, I've got to clear up. Tony has to write his novel." That I was there at the beginning of Dance, the Music of Time. Extraordinary.
That was just before the first Volume, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And before they moved, I think it was basically written, your authority, wasn't it basically written in Dorset?
In Somerset, yes, at the Chantry, yes, yes. Right. I think the first two volumes might have been written in Regent's Park, and then the rest were written.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. As I said, you first published King Arthur in 1954, so that was just before moving here, but most of your books, when you haven't been in libraries, obviously, have been written in this house, is that right?
Yes, I would say this has been my centre of all my activities. Two of my children were actually born here, Benji and Natasha. The other four, not before and after.
And we're sitting in your lovely drawing room, but you do your writing upstairs, is that right?
Well, it's changed over the years. When I first came here, there was nowhere for me to write. I just wrote in my bedroom. As the children grew up and actually left home, or sort of left home, I moved into the nursery, and there was a terrible scene when someone, I shan't name it, one of my children, stamped into the nursery and saw it full of history books and said, "But Mum, this is our nursery."
And wasn't there a notice on your writing room aimed at your children?
There certainly was a very important notice saying nobody allowed in.
And so do you think the writer really, particularly a writer with six children, really needs an iron will to get the book done?
Looking back, I think I must have had an iron will, because the day I began to write Mary Queen of Scots, I realised that I was pregnant with my sixth child, which was a surprise. And I suppose other people might have found another solution, but to me there was only one solution, which is one house and one book.
And you're, I think, the first of your distinguished siblings to write a book. Your brother Thomas wrote one quite soon afterwards, but you were the first, and your parents and many of your aunts and uncles wrote. Do you think it's a sort of addiction, writing?
Well, I think it is with me. With Thomas, Thomas is a very good writer. I mean, his specialised work on trees is really highly regarded by trees themselves. They wave at him.
Yes.
My mother was a very good writer, but she wrote her first book when she was 60, so it sort of varied.
But so when you wrote your first book, I think at the age of 22, wasn't it?
Published at 22.
Written when you were 21,
yes.
Probably. And had you felt this urge to write for many years before?
Oh, yes, I wrote. I was a sort of... I was aiming to be Jilly Cooper, although I didn't know it. Wonderful Jilly Cooper. That's, if I'd known she existed, or she was going to exist, that's the sort of writer I wanted to be.
And the genesis of that first book, because you had worked in publishing, hadn't you, for Lord Weidenfeld?
Yeah, I was working for George Weidenfeld. I went the day I left Oxford, virtually, immediately, and we published books in Marks and Spencer in huge orders of classics, because you didn't have to pay any copyright. And every season, George Weinfeld would go and meet the directors of Marks and Spencer and come back with a list of classics. And one day he came back and said, "King Arthur." And I said, "You can't do that, because there's no copyright-free classic. T.H. White is in copyright." I was rather pleased with myself to know this information. And George simply looked at me, waved a hand and said, "Then you, Antonia, will write it." And so I did.
And I once asked you where the writing gene came from in the Pakenham family. You said it begins with you, but there certainly is a thing, I've had it as well, if you grow up in a family where people write books, it doesn't seem daunting, the prospect of writing a book, does it?
No, after all, Harry, you grew up in a, you know, you were very close always to the Poles.
Yes, so we saw Anthony Pole every year a lot, yes, and my dad writes books. So it doesn't seem a difficult thing to do. And also, you know, of course, you end up having contacts as well. Yeah.
Yes.
And your approach to writing, has it changed over the last 71 years, or are there things that pretty much stay the same?
I think basically it stays the same. Of course, I've got much more meticulous, you know, and I'm very keen on things like structure, which I never knew existed. You know, I think half of what my readers like about my book is the structure.
Yes. You said a thing to me a few years ago that in later life, writing books are an extremely good thing to do because you look forward to the proofs, the publication, the wonderful launch party which you had last week, the reviews, seeing the hard copy in your hand. So it's a wonderful thing to look forward to, isn't it?
It's absolutely true. The extraordinary thing is, while I was waiting for you to arrive, I was thinking that, as though for the first time, what a nice thing. I haven't had any reviews yet, because it's only just been published, but it's lovely having something to look forward to, and which I said this to one of my grandchildren, who said, supposing the views are bad, Grandma? I said, the great thing is not to contemplate the possibility. And then when it happens, you can be horrified.
And you still get the pleasure, I'm sure you know this line from John Betjeman, who you knew well, who had tremendous pressure from his father to go to the family business, making Tantaluses, the drinks cabinets that you could lock to keep the drink from the servants, and he felt perhaps he should have gone to the family business, but every time he got a new copy of his poems, the actual hard, the copy in a new book, he said this was worth it.
Well, if the great Betjeman said it, he put it perfectly. I always feel that about everything. It was worth it.
And Antonio, you've written a terrific article in the latest Oldie, and you talk about your second marriage to Harold Pinter, the great playwright who lived in this house for 50 years, I think. And he needed a separate writing room. What's the story of him finding a writing room very nearby?
Well, he did find my teenage children, much as he loved them. But shall we say, their hours were rather different from his. Anyway, one day he said, I noticed he hadn't written, and I was slightly worried by it without knowing what to do, knowing I could do nothing. And then he said to me, didn't you look at a house? And I had looked at a house at the bottom of my garden in the next door road. I had sort of idea of increasing my property. It's an idea which was squished very quickly by my bank in one of those letters beginning, Dear Lady Antonia, I don't think you realise. Anyway, he said, oh, well, up I go. So he jumped up, took his checkbook, which was unusual, and went round to see the man. The house was literally at the bottom of our garden. Exactly. But one house down, one house up. Anyway, he banged on the door. The owner was there, and he said, I've come to buy your house. And the owner said, well, two people are fighting over it, but they never give the money. Harold said, how much? Harold was nothing if not active. And he named a sum, and Harold sort of added sixpence or something. and wrote it there and then and gave it him.
And it had a very good name, this house.
It was known as a super study.
Super study is extremely
and
good.
And the first thing he did was write Betrayal, which is probably now his most popular play. It was done, for instance, by Daniel Craig on Broadway. It doesn't come much better.
And did you, while you were both, he was writing his plays, you were writing your books, did you discuss them with each other?
Yes, we were very open. We wrote totally different things. Harold had been married to a very distinguished actress. And then with a playwright and an actress, and is she going to be in the play, or is it, all sorts of things. None of this occurred between us. We just both wrote quite happily. Oh, yes. I mean, I loved Lunchtime. Did you write a play today? And Harold had a tremendous feeling. You would have loved him in your office. Tremendous feeling for language. Frightfully, I mean, sort of faultless kind of. Somehow it was all there, his love of language.
And would you suggest changes in his plays to him, and would he suggest changes in your books to you?
I would never. Oh, I thought you meant now. No.
No, exactly. No, when he was writing them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. With Betrayal, I said, there's a scene missing. And Harold was frightfully angry and went walking round Holland Park at high speed, came back and wrote the scene, but it wasn't the scene I meant.
Really?
It meant quite a different scene, a brilliant scene.
And would he... How good was Harold's historical knowledge?
It was... pretty elementary, but at the same time, that was wonderful for me. When I was writing about Marie Antoinette, he said, who is this man, Robespierre? You should explain entirely who he was. And I said, everybody knows who Robespierre was. And he said, well, everybody doesn't. And I took the point that it's perfectly possible to have heard, of course, of Robespierre, but not to know what he did.
Because when you're writing, are you writing for the man or woman on the Clapham omnibus? Do you have a perfect reader in mind?
I think I'm writing... I'm writing for a pat on the back from my mother, really, who's died at the age of 96 a long time ago.
But because she's a very distinguished historian, biographer, not least of the Duke of Wellington, you would talk to her a lot about history, would you?
I would talk to her, but you see, she wasn't a historian, curious enough. She read classics at Oxford. She only became a historian when my mother could never be idle, admirable quality, and she had planned to be a politician. And then she realised it was impossible with my father to have two politicians. She made the decision. And she then applied to write A Life of Queen Victoria and wrote this absolutely brilliant book. Have you read it lately?
The Biography of Wellington?
No, Queen Victoria.
Oh, yes. No, I read that a long time ago, yes.
Terribly good.
Very good, yeah.
Still very good. And she had a sort of talent for it.
And your father, Lord Longford, although best known as a prison campaigner and politician, actually wrote a significant amount of books and wrote an extremely good book about Ireland when very young.
Yes.
His knowledge of history must have been pretty good,
isn't it? Yes. When he was a Don, and he knew people like De Valera, and used that knowledge. I've just been reading one of his books and also reading one of Roy Foster's books, who I much admire.
Brilliant historian, yep.
And together. I'm getting educated about Irish history.
And this house, as well as seeing you and Harold write your marvellous books, has seen many a famous face. Many of them are pictured in your book and in the oldies, Salman Rushdie, Yong Chang, Tom Stoppard. I mean, the list is endless, but Robert De Niro, I think, has been a visitor. So the house has seen a lot of distinguished people.
The house likes distinguished people.
And then, very sadly, Harold died in 2008. And there's a very moving ceremony that takes place here at Christmas. Can you, in the square outside your house, can you describe it?
On Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve, yeah.
Everybody puts candles in our window. We have no electric lights. It's a tradition which a lady in my house brought from Philadelphia, where Bavarian workmen brought it. And it's absolutely extraordinary. And he died on Christmas Eve. And Benji, my son, drove me back. And we had to go all the way around the square because of the traffic. And the flickering candles was like a tribute to Harold. I've never forgotten it.
Very moving. And you describe a very tragic event in the square 50 years ago when the distinguished doctor Gordon Hamilton Fairley was killed by a terrorist bomb. Can you explain what happened?
Yes, it was a real tragedy. The bomb was intended for Hugh Fraser, my first husband, and apparently put by the IRA.
Why was he particularly targeted?
Well, that is a good question, which has never been answered, because he was a Catholic and a keen Catholic and therefore very sympathetic to Catholics in Northern Ireland. For instance, in the House of Commons, he's very friendly with Bernadette Devlin. It was obviously a sort of mistake, but what a mistake. The poor, wonderful doctor worked in cancer, I believe. Very nice neighbour, you know. Ran out with his little dog. And that was it.
And I think Hugh was just leaving the house at the time, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. Hugh was saved by a miraculous telephone call from a friend of ours. And the nanny, because some of my children were there, the nanny said, "Oh, it's for you, Sir Hugh." And he said, "Well, I want to do something, or see somebody. Could you take Orlando, our youngest child, to school in your car?" And she said, "OK." So she took him out of danger in her car, leaving poor Gordon Hamilton Fairley and his doggy to poke under Hugh's rather ostentatious car.
Because he had spotted something unusual, had he?
I think the dog had.
The dog had.
You know, a little white dog.
Oh, God.
It was so awful. And then I was living with Hugh, with Harold, in another house, sort of more kind of near Harvey Nichols, and the telephone rang and it was our nanny, and she was sort of gibbering and sobbing. I couldn't understand what she was saying. Car, car. And then I heard the word bomb. Can you imagine? Horror.
Also in that year, 50 years ago, your first husband, Hugh Fraser, stood in the contest to become Conservative leader against somebody called Margaret Thatcher. I wonder what happened to her. She, in fact, would have been 100 in months' time.
Oh, no, is that
yes,
true?
Yes, she's about to have a big centenary. What were Hugh's motives in standing? Did he think he might win?
I asked him. He said that he didn't think it was time for a woman to lead the Tory party. I was rather cross. I said, "Why not?
And it was clear quite early on in the voting that Hugh wouldn't win. But Was it clear earlier on that Maggie would win?
I think it was suspected. I mean, everybody was guessing and chatting. I may say I was totally on her side. I thought it was absolutely time a woman should win, and I always admired her from the beginning to the end. One of the things about her, which I don't think has survived, even in Charles Moore's excellent book, she was a very pretty woman.
Yes, my dad, who worked for her, said first in the 60s and then in the 80s, said exactly that. She's extremely good looking.
How interesting, because your father knew her very well.
Yes.
Saw her daily. How interesting.
And, Antonio, you've written recently in the Aldi about another major figure of the, perhaps the major figure of the 20th, early 21st century, the late Queen. You met her many times. Did you ever work out what was going on inside that brilliant sphinx-like mind?
Never for one minute. I was fascinated by her. I think one of the most emotional days I've had was when I sat with my son watching the funeral. You know, I felt so much for her, such gratitude to her. Because, you see, remembering the war, as I obviously do as a child, when she was so wonderful in the war, going into the ATS, you know, in her uniform, mending lorries. There's a wonderful picture of her. Do you know it?
Yes, yes, very famous picture, yes. And you wrote recently in the Aldi about you celebrating VJ Day with your brother, Thomas Pakenham. And unbeknownst to you, I think at the time, she was there as Princess Elizabeth in the crowds too.
Absolutely. And when we discovered they'd been there, we thought we might have met the corgis, because they always went everywhere with the corgis.
So, last question, Antonio. You've written 40 books. Surely time for the 41st?
Yes, any ideas?
Not so far. Anyway, thank you so much to Lady Antonia Fraser for appearing on Radio Aldie. You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.